Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Native Plant Podcast. I'm your springing into warmer weather someday, at least I hope, host, John McGee, coming to you not so live from the soon-to-be-flowering inn. I just know it's going to happen. Headquarters of McGee Design in beautiful Middleburg, Virginia. And tonight, I'm joined by my co-host with the most, the artesano of North Carolina, Mr. Preston Montague, landscape designer, artist, and naturalist. Hey, Preston, how you doing?
Hey, John, I'm doing all right. We had the pollen drop last week, and we've had a late winter, and it just wouldn't relent. And last week, it finally yielded. And I think just everything that could drop pollen did, and in one day. And it was almost like yellow snowfall. And I think we've all gotten sick here in the triangle, myself included. I'm hoping my voice tonight sounds that kind of like gravelly sexy instead of just kind of like snotty and exhausted. So we're hoping for the former. But cool. But hey, all's well. Spring has sprung. It looks gorgeous. I'm looking outside my window right now. The warm season is here, so no complaints.
Yeah.
What's going on there in Middleburg?
Well, you know, Middleburg can't decide whether it's still winter or spring yet. We keep going back and forth. It's supposed to get down, I think, to 28 degrees tonight, and so can't put any plants out yet, as I'd like to do. But we're supposed to have 75, 80 by the end of the week. And so if that happens, things are going to explode. But Preston, I wanted to talk to you tonight because one of your favorite plants is blooming in my garden right at this very moment. What? You know what it is?
Crepe myrtle.
Close, but no.
Iliagnus. No, what's blooming?
Xanthorrhiza simplicifolia.
Ooh!
Yellow root.
It's like this, like little fireworks display, right? Of these mauvey, purpley brown flowers. Yeah. So weird. It's so weird. Yeah, I love Xanthorrhiza.
Didn't you use it in one of your codexes or something? Or you have a drawing of it, don't you?
Yeah, that was one of the very first ones I drew. In fact, I draw them kind of out of order. So for those who may not know, Codex Carolinum is a graphic novel about North Carolina nature that I'm drawing, using the alphabet as a structure. So A for alder, B for butterfly weed, etc. And Y is for yellow root. And it was one of the very first ones I drew. But it was the very first one that I drew insects in. It was supposed to be a very strict botanical illustration project, but while drawing yellow root, I was visited by these emerald damselflies that were really bold, really brave, and had this most fascinating behavior. And I thought, I think these guys have to be in the picture. And ever since then, I've been throwing birds and butterflies and bees and all sorts of things. So yeah, that one's really near and dear to my heart. And it's water loving, which means it's Preston loving.
Well, I first saw it up at Mount Cuba, and I was actually with, I'm forgetting her name, the lady who owned Mount Cuba. And just by luck, you know, we walked across and there it was in full blooming. Today I got out of my car and I have it right at the entrance to our property, and there it was, just blooming. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, what a perfect thing for Preston tonight that I can tell him that my yellow root is blooming. So
yeah, shoot me a pic of that. I don't spec that ever.
Yeah.
I just have not been progressive enough to include that in my designs, but I understand in Europe, England specifically, that you see it used as a perennial from time to time.
Huh. Well, I would actually call it a woody, you know, a subshrub myself because the stems on it are pretty woody. But yeah, I'm like you. I don't spec it in much, but you know, if I've got the right spot for it, I certainly do. The problem, reason I don't spec it in is because you just can't find it in the trade, and I don't understand why, because it's pretty easy to grow.
Yeah,
you know, it spreads pretty quickly in a happy place, and so I would think you'd be able to take divisions and cuttings and all those things and make little baby plants, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Well, maybe there's just absolutely no demand for it because it's so moisture dependent.
Yeah, but you know, the juncus is out there, cinnamon ferns are out there. There's lots of plants that are very moisture dependent that are in the trade. I think it just hasn't really found its place and been discovered yet. So hopefully, maybe after people listen to this podcast, they'll be like, gosh, I got to go check out Yellow Root and see what that's all about.
It just needs a PR campaign. I get it.
We're here for you.
Well, John, Yellow Root can't be the only thing blooming for you, is it?
No, we've got the bluebells are just getting started. You know, close by, we've got some bluebells, but here at my place, they're not blooming yet. They're not even really emerged. Skunk cabbage is up and doing its thing. And, you know, pretty soon, Preston, it's going to be that favorite time of year for me, which is, of course, when the morels start appearing. And I went today and I was looking for them, but they're not up yet. Still a little too early.
Because you have several patches on your property, is that right?
No, don't ever repeat that again.
I see.
No, there are no morels anywhere near me. No.
Understood. Wink.
Wink, wink. No morels wink, here. Wink. Wink, wink. Yeah, no, we have a couple of patches that I hope have a good harvest this year. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, well, share. Can you believe I've never had a morel?
Oh. Well, next time you come up, we'll have them.
Yeah, pop a few in the freezer. I can be indulged for sure.
Well, we eat a bunch of them fresh, and then we dry a bunch of them. So we pretty much have morels year round here, because we conserve them.
And what do you do? Drop them in soup, or throw them into a pasta, or a souffle, or casserole, or something?
You know, I've told this story before, but my wife, as you know, Preston, my wife is one of the greatest cooks in the world. She really is. She's an amazing, amazing chef. And there was one year where we got just a bunch of morels. And so we were having morels in our eggs for breakfast, in our sandwiches for lunch, in our stews for dinner. And I was feeling really awesome, and I was like going down the road one day, and I was like, man, I feel great. You know, this is, you know, life is really good and everything's awesome. And I couldn't figure out why, but then I went home and I did a little research on morels, and they actually stimulate your endorphins. And so they make you feel really awesome. And so, you know, we'd been kind of ODing on morels for a couple of days, and I was feeling awesome. It was pretty wonderful.
I didn't realize that. So you got a mushroom high.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a mushroom high, yeah. I hadn't shroomed in a long time, you know, so.
All right, well, I look forward to that that runner's high at your place. There mushroom you go. Soup, let's do it. There let's you go. Do it.
Yeah.
Well, there's plenty blooming here, John. I'll tell you, there's so much on the floor. Now, you and I haven't talked in a couple of weeks, and there's just been so much to talk about phenology-wise. And up until now, I'd have probably talked about, well, spring ephemerals, forbs on the forest floor. But right now, all the action is in the trees.
Oh.
It's the red buds, cyrsus. Have been in full bloom for a week now. It's just solid pink up and down the highways.
Wow.
The dogwoods, cornus, are beginning to open up now, but so are the elms, ulmus, and the maples. The red maples have been doing their thing for several weeks, but I'm starting to see other species of maple pop open. And, of course, the oaks are beginning to kind of ooze out their catkins. I know their next, I guess pine, which I don't really kind of think often when I'm thinking flowering trees, but that's what really hit us with the pollen last week were the pines. And I know the oaks are just getting ready to start. So that's kind of that 1-2 pollen punch we can all look forward to. So right now, the spring ephemerals are doing their thing. You can still find bloodwort, hepatica in the forest. Because we had such a late winter, everything is kind of compressed this year. And it's all doing its thing at once. So it's just been a really, it's been really gorgeous to look at through my snot rag.
Very cool. That's awesome.
John, tell us who we have on tonight.
Who do we have on tonight? Well, tonight, Preston, we have a what I like to call a boomerang guest because, you know, they've been here before, and it hasn't really even been that long since he was on the show. But tonight we have Aaron Ellison, who is Senior Research Fellow in Ecology at the Harvard Forest, and he's also about a billion other things, but his bio was so long that I just kind of cut it off and said, okay, he's a plant guy and he knows his stuff. But, you know, last time he was here, he mainly talked about hemlocks and art, as we were talking with David Buckley Borden at the same time in the Hemlock Hospice project. But it turns out that Aaron just published a book on one of my absolutely favorite topics, and I think it's also a favorite topic of yours, Preston, and that is carnivorous plants. And I don't think ever hear enough about carnivorous plants. So, Preston, if you would please welcome to the show Professor Aaron Ellison.
Dr. Ellison, we're so happy to have you.
Hey, that's great. I'm happy to be back.
Welcome back. All right.
Well, what's going on up in New England phenology-wise? Are you guys, is anything breaking dormancy yet at this point?
Well, you know, we're probably a good month behind you guys down in Virginia and North Carolina. The red maples have just been open a week or so, and we're getting some of the bloodroot and hepatica coming up, the real early stuff, but it's been a late spring here. I guess by historical standards, it's a normal spring, but by what we've gotten used to in the last 20 or 30 years, it's a late spring. But we don't have the big pollen dump yet, so my voice is in better shape, but it's coming. It'll be like you warming up down there this weekend. We're supposed to be pushing up into the 60s by the end of the week, and I expect all the trees will start opening up. Certainly the flowers, the spring ephemerals will start coming up, and everything's waking up, and we're sure ready for it because we had that whole run of 3-4 nor'easters in a row, and it's enough already.
Yeah,
imagine.
I was curious, you know, we're going to be talking about pitcher plants tonight, or carnivorous plants tonight, excuse me, that's a much broader term, but I know there's a lot of New England bogs. Are any of them kind of breaking dormancy? And what happens when a bog breaks dormancy? Who goes first and that kind of thing?
Well, you know, bogs, of course, are big open, essentially big open puddle on the landscape. And so cold air sinks, and bogs are remarkably cold places in a surrounding area of much warmer things. And so they're probably, I haven't even been out in the bogs yet this spring, but I expect the water is still frozen in most of the bogs right now. The red maples will be some of the first things that'll come out. Some of the Ericaceae will be early. The blueberries will come out pretty early. The pitcher plants will be the first of the carnivorous plants to flower. Usually they flower about recent years they flower middle of May, but I expect this year they'll flower about the third or fourth week of May this year. And in our bogs, you can get frost every month of the year.
Wow.
And so in the New Jersey Pine Barrens, they have recorded in the bog areas. There's some great carnivorous plant bogs in the New Jersey Pine Barrens, and they have recorded frosts in July and August there, as have we up here in Massachusetts.
Wow.
So it's a really unique and interesting habitat all over here, but it's a very, very compressed growing season in the bog. So the pitcher plants, they'll start flowering in May, and it's all over for them by the beginning of September, end of August. The sundews will start coming up, and they'll come up vegetatively first, probably in early June, and then they'll flower late June, early July. Hmm. All the bladderworts will flower in middle of July, and everything's all gone by back into dormancy by August.
Wow.
Hmm. Yeah, it's really fast.
Well, Aaron, kind of jumping into the heart of the matter here, one of the many reasons we brought you back as a boomerang guest was to talk about your book, Carnivorous Plants, Physiology, Ecology, and Evolution. And I wondered if you couldn't tell us really why it is carnivorous plants exist even in the first place.
So that's a really interesting question. At one level, of course, all plants are carnivorous in the sense that through their roots, they're taking up nutrients that have been produced by the decomposition of other kinds of organic matter, whether that's leaf litter or decomposing animal carcasses, insect carcasses. So at one level, that's where plants get their nutrients from, or some of their nutrients from. But carnivorous plants do this in a very different way. They actually are attracting and capturing and killing and digesting live animals. And mostly that's live insects. It's not like in Little Shop of Horrors where they're grabbing passerbys off the street. But occasionally you do find salamanders or small mammals in carnivorous plants here and around the world. But by and large, as Darwin noted in his book, they're insectivorous plants. And where you find carnivorous plants are in places where there aren't very many nutrients in the soil. So you find carnivorous plants in bogs, on the tops of granite massifs, the tepuis in South America, for example, places where there's almost no nutrients in the soil. Now, that's not to say there aren't other ways that plants can get nutrients in very nutrient-poor soils. There are mycorrhizae, there are associations with the roots, there are other adaptations that plants have for sucking nutrients out of poor soils, but carnivory is one way to do that. And it turns out, evolutionarily, it's not a very difficult way to do that. And so carnivorous plants have evolved multiple times in the plant kingdom, in multiple different, at least 10 or 11 different flowering plant lineages, completely unrelated to one another. So it's not a hard thing to do.
So that's interesting. So plants, you're saying, are obviously accustomed to drawing nutrients. I guess we're more familiar with drawing nutrients from the soil where these plant matter or insects have decomposed. And so in environments where these plants have not been able to, having an assist from mycorrhiza or some of these other adaptations, they've had to go get aggressive, is what you're saying, and create the nutrients for themselves.
That's basically right. And as you mentioned, bogs up here in New England, bogs are the best place to go find carnivorous plants. And the dominant shrubby vegetation in bogs are things in the blueberry family. So blueberries, yes, and sheep laurel and bog laurel and what's that?
Cranberry.
Cranberry, yep, of course. Yep. All the different, you know, the huckleberry, the blueberry. All of these are in the same family, in the Ericaceae, and they actually have a very special kind of mycorrhiza that goes with them, the ericoid mycorrhizae that are helping them get nutrients out of the very, very nutrient poor peat. Carnivorous plants have just gone another direction, and plants, of course, are involved in this constant what we call coevolutionary arms race with with insects, right? Where insects want to come and eat the plant, and then the plant produces some compound that the insect finds unpalatable, and then the insect figures out how to overcome that, and then the plant comes up with some other compound. And so these defensive compounds have actually been co-opted evolutionarily and molecularly to be the things that make the plants insectivorous. So it's the next stage in this coevolutionary arms race.
Wow, that's exciting. Well, go ahead, John.
Well, I was going to say, I just love that term, the arms race. And, you know, I was thinking back, and I was going to ask you about the evolution of carnivorous plants, because it seems like way back when, at the very beginning, when there wasn't much nutrients in the soil, maybe that is another time where they needed to bring in nutrients another way. Is that the case?
Well, you know, interesting. That's a very interesting and astute observation. And for many years, there were some plant evolutionary biologists who actually placed carnivorous plants at the base of the angiosperm, the flowering plant lineage, tree of life. But it turns out that that's actually not the case, that they're very derived, relatively recent additions to the flora. But it's a logical question to ask, because at some point there weren't so many nutrients, but it was really things that could break down the rocks and minerals and other things to extract the nutrients that way that went first. But for a long time, people thought all the carnivorous plants, evolutionary biologists thought all the carnivorous plants were related to one another, and that they were very ancestral in the plant lineages.
But you're saying that there have been these big gaps in time between the evolution of different species.
That's right. And in fact, they show up now in many different lineages. So there are monocots that are carnivorous. There are some carnivorous bromeliads,
wow,
things that are related to the pipeworts. And then there are carnivorous things in the Caryophyllaceae, the sandworts.
Wow.
So that's where sundews, as well as the Asian pitcher plants, Nepenthes and the Venus flytraps, are in that group. And then Sarracenia, our American pitcher plants, along with Darlingtonia out west and Heliamphora in South America, and the South African Voridula, they're in the group with the Ericales, the same big group that has the blueberries in them. And then they're the bladderworts and butterworts, Pinguicula and Utricularia, and the corkscrew plants, Genlicia, and those are all in the Lamiales, which have the mints,
yes,
in them. So they're just scattered all over the angiosperm tree.
That's amazing.
Well, while we're talking about specific species, Aaron, just the carnivorous plants endemic to North America, can you give us a chronology of some of the more familiar species that enthusiasts would recognize? Can you kind of place maybe like the big seven or the big five in chronological order as far as age? Like who appeared first and then who appeared most recently?
So, you know, I know the pitcher plants best off the top of my head. And in North America, we've got 11 species of Sarracenia, most of which are in the southeast. Then we have the Darlingtonia in the Pacific Northwest, and Darlingtonia is the most ancestral of all of those, probably 25 million years old or something like that. Saracenia radiated only, you know, the last 3 or 4 million years. And then, of course, we have the sundews. We have lots of sundews in North America, not as many as we have in some of the other parts of the world. But sundews are on the order of about 50 million years old. The Venus flytrap, of course, that everyone knows on the border of North and South Carolina is about 50 million years old. And the other ones we have here in North America, we've got the butterworts and the bladderworts, and they're on the order of 30 million years old. So none of these are really very, very old. The bromeliad ones in South America and Peplanthus, the pipewort family one, those are only about 2 million years old.
That's amazing stuff. You know, I to change the topic a little bit here, I did a project up in New Hampshire a while ago, and on the site there were several bogs, and a few of those were turned into cranberry bogs, which I guess is a farming technique up there, but some were still fairly intact with, you know, like you were mentioning, high bush blueberry, a lot of the ericaceous species, black spruces, and the like. And, you know, I was curious, I'd like to talk about conservation of bogs in New England for a moment. Is that happening? And, or, you know, like in a lot of places, bogs get a bad rep, like swamps do. You know, we hear these terms like drain the swamp and whatever, but
yeah,
you know, these are really important places. Is what's the situation up in New England with conservation and bogs?
So up here in New England, bogs are protected as habitats in New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. All the bogs are protected as habitats, and most of them are conservation protected at the state level. Maine is a bit more flexible in the sense there are just so many bogs in Maine. And so the inland bogs don't have the same degree of protection as the coastal bogs. There's a very interesting set of bogs along what we call down east Maine. So you go from Camden, Maine, east to the Canadian border with New Brunswick. And there are some very interesting blanket bogs where the peat just sort of drapes over granite bedrock, very nutrient poor. Magnificent flora, really super interesting floras. Almost all of those have been protected by either state agencies or NGOs. So what's interesting, I of course have done research in all throughout New England on pitcher plants and other carnivorous plants, and I have to get permits to work in the habitat. The plants themselves are quite common. Once you get into the habitat. So I don't actually need a permit to study the plants, but I need a permit to access the habitat. So for the most part, the habitats, the bogs are conserved. And in most of the New England states, we have very strong wetlands protection acts. And the bogs, of course, all come under wetlands. So they're all what we call jurisdictional for the state wetlands acts, and so very, very difficult to do any development work or anything in the bogs up here.
What about
which applies, of course, to the other wetlands too?
Okay, what about poaching? I know down where Preston is in North Carolina with the Venus's flytrap. Something they get poached all the time. Does that happen up where you are as well?
It doesn't happen as much, although pitcher plants, we only have one species of pitcher plant up here, and you will occasionally see it collected from the field. They're awfully easy to grow, though, so people don't poach it as often. What's actually a little more curious, of course, pitcher plants And Venus flytraps are available widely on the horticultural market, and you can buy them at Home Depot, for example, or Lowe's. You can go in and buy Venus flytraps. And then people, if they know what they're doing with them, they say, oh, well, my plant has to go dormant in the winter. And you can put it in your refrigerator, you can put it in your cool garage in the winter, and it'll overwinter just fine. But people will actually outplant the southern species, Venus flytraps or southern pitcher plants. They'll go and plant them in the bogs here, and then go back out and recollect them in the spring as a way to overwinter them. And so that's really different. And I've actually been called a couple times by the Nature Conservancy to say, well, what should we do with the Sarracenia flava, the yellow pitcher plant that that we just found in our Massachusetts bog, and what's it doing here? What should we do about it? And because it's now, our winters are now warm enough that they would certainly overwinter here. Ooh. And Venus flytraps are all over the Pine Barrens now, completely naturalized in the Pine Barrens because people have planted them out. And in fact, you were talking at the beginning of the show about yellow root. It's all over New England as well. It's in Maine and the southern New England states where it's been planted and naturalized in the wetlands up here. So, but I wouldn't say poaching is a big problem here, but it's a very large problem it's probably a big problem, of course, for Venus flytraps. And occasionally in the news, you'll get stories about people who have been arrested for that. But I think the biggest problems with poaching are with the Asian pitcher plants in Southeast Asia, where there are lots and lots of species, and many of them are endemic to single mountaintops or single valleys. And when a new species is discovered, they'll just get poached out. It's just like your morels in your backyard, John. No one wants to say they're there, because as soon as they're there, they're gone.
Yeah, there are no morels in my house. No. There are no morels anywhere near me.
Absolutely not.
Well, Aaron, where do you do a lot of the research for your book? Do you have test bogs there at the Harvard Forest, or do you do a lot of your research in the field, in the wild?
Well, I do most of my research in the field. I do observational research all over New England, all over the world. I do a lot of my experimental research here at Harvard Forest. We have a very large bog complex as part of our land holdings at Harvard Forest, where I do field experimental work. And then, of course, I do a lot of physiology and evolutionary work using greenhouse, growing material in the greenhouse, and then working with that. So we do all the different pieces.
Wow. And I'd imagine that each one of those scenarios provides different sorts of opportunities for different types of research. You can create control situations there at Harvard Forest and in the lab, but presumably there are relationships and interactions ecologically that happen in these test sites and then in the larger kind of wild that you've
Well, that's exactly right. You know, you do the observational studies around the region, around the world, to identify general patterns and get ideas about how things work, and then you test them more mechanistically using experiments either in the field or in the greenhouse. You of course have much more control of things in the greenhouse, but you lose some of the realism, and we're very fortunate here at Harvard Forest to be able to do some of the work in the field as well.
Yeah.
Of course, it's the same deal. You're working in a bog. It's a protected habitat. You got to get a permit to go in and do the work in the field, both to do the observational work, but also to do the experimental work when we put in plants or take out plants or have to put a boardwalk into a site to do experimental work. All of that is regulated very extensively.
Interesting.
Well, and you mentioned that carnivorous plants are found all over the place, but you know, you talked about the South American ones, the Japanese, the Nepenthes, of course, is one of my favorite genuses. what are some of the limiting factors that drive their populations? Where do you typically find a carnivorous plant growing? And I'm curious what the weirdest place you've ever seen them grow is.
So the key thing about carnivorous plants is they're found in habitats that have three characteristics. The first is that they're wet. The second is that they're bright. And the third is that they have virtually no nutrients. So bogs, the sand outwash plains in the southeast, the tepuis in South America, the white gravel streams in the Amazon, in Africa, all of these are the places that you find carnivorous plants. I don't know what the weirdest place. I mean, bogs and seepage swamps and things are definitely weird. But I guess for me, it's not weird, but it's certainly the most beautiful place. I spent 3 summers working on the California pitcher plant, also called the cobra lily.
Yeah.
On the Oregon California border. And this is real Northern California, like 7 hours, 300 miles north of San Francisco. And so you're in serpentine mountain ranges that are super, super dry. And so very little vegetation. But then you get these serpentine streams, and you just get this explosion of vegetation right in these seeps. You get gentians, and you get just thousands of these cobra lilies, and is just one of the most beautiful sights I've ever seen. So I don't know if it's the weirdest place, but for me, it's the most beautiful place.
Yeah, cobra lilies are really a beautiful plant, and of course, gentians are one of my favorite groups of plants.
Yeah.
And to see those guys doing it together, I can only imagine what that is.
Yeah. You know, what's fascinating about carnivorous plants, besides the obvious, the fact that they're, predators? No, that's not the right word. But
They are predators. That, absolutely,
yeah.
Right.
Oh. Well, so that's unexpected. But what's also unexpected to me is the just sheer number of morphological features that define these plants. And the variety of species. I mean, whether it's Sarracenia or Drosera, the bladderworts, they're so wildly different. And Aaron, I wondered if you could share some insight into why they're so wildly different. Is it their response to when they evolved at different time periods, or what accounts for the surprising morphological diversity and technological diversity?
Well, so the interesting thing is you look at it and see a bunch of a surprising diversity of forms, but there's actually a remarkably small number of forms given their evolutionary diversity.
Hmm.
We divide them up. You can think of it, the most common ones are the sticky traps, the flypaper traps. So the sundews have sticky leaves. Rorigula in South America has sticky leaves. Drosophyllum has sticky leaves. Butterworts have sticky leaves. All of these have basically have leaves with sticky glands on them. And sundews are not related to butterworts, are not related to a rorigula. But in every case, in every one of these lineages, after you evolve, after the sticky trap one has evolved, the next step evolutionarily is something more complicated. And so from in the same evolutionary group or clade that you have sundews, you have Venus flytraps, which are the snap traps, and then you have Nepenthes, which are the Asian pitcher plants, and those are very close. They're all very closely related to each other. And then you go to the Lamiales, the mint family order one. You start with the butterworts, which are sticky, and then you go on to the corkscrew plant and the bladderworts with the snapping bladders. And then in Sarracenia, the pitcher plants, the American pitcher plants, is the exception, because even though they're related to Varigula, which is another sticky one, there it's the other way around, where in that clade, the pitcher plant comes first and the sticky one comes second. We have pitcher plants. We have the American pitcher plants. We have the Asian pitcher plants. And we have the Australian pitcher plant, Cephalotus, in three completely different groups. So Nepenthes is in the caryophylls, and Sarracenia is in the Ericales, and Cephalotus in Australia is in the Oxalidales, in the wood sorrel group. But all of them are pitcher plants, and they're all developmentally, they work the same. They're a modified leaf that has been evolutionarily modified in the same way. And even the bromeliad, carnivorous bromeliads, the Brocinia and Catopsis, they're pitcher plants. They basically are a pitfall trap. And so despite there being, now more than 800 species of carnivorous plant, the actual number of body plans, of ways they do things, there's sticky ones, there are pitfall ones, there are snap ones, and there are suction ones. And it's, for evolutionary biologists, it's one of the greatest examples of convergent evolution that we know of. So it's really a great example of things converging on similar solutions. And part of that seems to be that they all use the same, as we talked about before, this co-evolutionary arms race, the way you go from plant defense to being a predator is a very similar evolutionary pathway.
So these instances of convergent evolution, it's almost like, I'm not quite even sure how to ask this. I guess I'll just ask it. It's almost as if the information to create this technology is in the plant, and it becomes expressed as the pressure demands. I mean, could you argue that perhaps in a very early time, plants had to get nutrients in this way, and they found other ways, but as different pressures have selected over time, those ancient technologies have had to reemerge?
Well, that could be. I mean, you're certainly right that the technology, as it were, the evolutionary pieces that make it possible to be carnivorous are there, right? They're there in the defensive compounds, and they're just co-opted under particular selection pressures to become carnivorous. And it happens again and again, and it's just not very hard once you have plants being able to defend themselves. It's as we see this anywhere, right? You go from defense to offense. It's a pretty quick and slippery slope.
You know, Aaron, I kind of want to change the direction of our talk here a minute, because, Preston and I are, of course, both commercial landscape designers, and as such, we're always looking for the next really cool thing. And as Mike and I used to always say, we were into native plants before being into native plants was cool. And I think I could say that about pitcher plants as well, because I've always had pitcher plants as a part of my repertoire as a designer. But I'm curious if you see this as a way of conserving these plants. To get back to conservation again, do you think enabling them to be more commercially available to gardeners will also protect them as a group of plants?
Well, I think that if they're available commercially, and people are, and they're actually quite easy to grow from tissue culture, from seed. And so the more widely they're available and grown reputably, the less pressure that'll put on wild populations. And so that's a great thing. Because they have very specific habitat requirements, particularly wet, if you're doing landscaping for wetland restoration and wetland recreation, it becomes a good option for landscaping and design. But they don't do very well in drier conditions. And so I don't, not being a landscape designer myself, I don't know what the market is for backyard bogs. But I suspect that's more of a niche market than other kinds of landscape design.
Mm, yeah. Falls in right behind putting courses, from what I understand.
Yeah. Well, you go from the putting green to the sand trap. A sand trap, if it was a nice wet sand trap, that would be a great place to grow Venus flytrap.
You could combine the two things.
The question is, what happens when one of those golf balls hits that sand trap and hits that trigger hair in the Venus flytrap? It's a short step to the next thing getting eaten.
It's the next step in evolution, Aaron.
That's it. Audrey Jr.
John, I don't spec carnivorous plants in my designs. I see them occasionally in really high-end displays at botanical gardens, where the intent is to display carnivorous plants. But I used to plant a lot more of them when I did ponds professionally.
Yeah.
And I think it's because it was so much easier to install a bog if you already had a big pool of water ready to keep it wet. But, in the landscape, I don't really kind of work with a diversity of landforms. And so I don't really work with a diversity of soil types. I think that's, as myself as a designer in the landscape, I don't really see a lot of opportunities for them. But in ponds, whenever we designed a pond back in the day, I always advocated for some sort of boggy edge, some sort of filter for that water to kind of push through, to act as a mechanical and a biological filter. And there, I typically had a lot of success, really, with Sarracenia. There weren't a lot of other carnivorous plants available to me at a reasonable price. This was early aughts. But there were a lot of Sarracenia on the market, and in fact, anything you could want. I remember even lots of hybrids, like Ladybug. That was kind of the start of the hybrids that I remember. Gosh, oh, I'm spacing on the other types. There was like almost like brands and lines of carnivorous plant of Sarracenia back then that I'm just now kind of seeing in garden supply magazines and nursery catalogs now. It's actually pretty fascinating, having now been out of the pond business for 15 years, how many plants I was introduced to then that are now cutting edge or kind of in the cool category in the catalog. Sarracenia, Drosera, and other things. But You do a lot of ponds. Do you ever spec carnivorous plants for your ponds or bogs?
Well, I just want to give a plug that one of these days coming up, Preston and I are going to do a show on water gardening.
Oh, yeah.
And so this is going to be a topic we'll probably cover then. But, yeah, pretty much every – we do a lot of building of water features, and most of them are – natural looking water features. They're not formal features. And I always try to find a space tucked into a corner where we can stick some pitcher plants or stick some. And we're talking about carnivorous plants tonight, but there's all kinds of really cool bog plants, and there's some really cool orchids that can grow in a bog. And you have to be careful with the pH of the water, the pond you're building. It's going to be pretty acidic if you're going to be growing those types of plants. But, yeah, wonderful opportunities, well, like you're saying, Preston.
I think the nutrient load was the problem for me. You know, yeah. If I've got koi or goldfish dumping huge volumes of nutrients in the water, and I'm using that bog as a filter,
not good.
I mean, it seems contrary to growing Sarracenia, but still, we did pretty well, pretty well.
You know, I was going to ask you. You already answered it about fossilized records of carnivorous plants, but I'm curious. Do you know when the earliest records are of when carnivorous plants existed?
Well, probably the earliest ones. I mean, there are not a lot of really well-known fossils of carnivorous plants. Probably the oldest ones might be maybe 80 million years ago for sundews. But there aren't a lot of fossils that we've got. And you know, the oldest lineages we've got for carnivorous plants maybe go back 90 million years.
Wow.
And part of it might just be that where they grow isn't particularly good environments for fossilization. I mean, peat bogs certainly are good, but a lot of them just don't persist. You know, the pieces don't persist and fossilize well. So, you know, we don't have a great fossil record for them. And compared with the rest of the angiosperms, which, you know, date 300 million years or so, carnivorous plants are really relative newcomers.
Well, Aaron, what kind of disease pressures are there on carnivorous plants?
So I don't know a lot about diseases in carnivorous plants. Certainly in the greenhouse, you get scale and mealybugs, and there are still herbivores that have figured out how to get around the traps and eat the plants in different ways. You know, there are certainly all sorts of diseases that these plants will get on occasion in the field, and then the plants have evolved to figure that out as well. And there are lots of medicinal attributes that have been described for many, many, many different carnivorous plants as well. That's a whole nother line of research. We could spend another hour on that without any problem.
So I'm just curious, Aaron, do you have a favorite group of carnivorous plants?
Well, most of my research for the last 20 years has been on pitcher plants, on American pitcher plants, and I really am quite fond of the pitcher plants. You know, you were talking about using them in water gardens. The pitcher plants are much more common in water gardens and bog gardens because they're big and easy to see. The sundews are really super easy to grow, but they're so small that people don't pay enough attention to them. So I'm a big fan of pitcher plants, and I like the American ones. They're just really, really beautiful.
I gotta
say,
so
showy.
I've gotta say that probably Sarracenia leucophylla, or the white top pitcher plant, is probably my favorite because it's the showiest
And those are the ones that are most heavily susceptible to poaching because they're used in the cut flower trade for flower arrangements.
I think I'm a fan of Flava. I've always loved that chartreuse color. In fact, I did a botanizing trip with a friend who's a wildlife specialist, and I got a sneak preview into one of North Carolina's new state parks that's going to feature carnivorous plants and bog plants in East North Carolina that are running the length of a power line corridor. And I understand it's going to be mostly a boardwalk experience. It's going to be fascinating. But I got to visit last April, and I learned a lot about the culture of Dionaea, the Venus flytrap, because I assumed that it would be growing the same way that I see Drosera, the sundews. And, you know, whenever you kind of have if you look at the ground, there's a gap between plants and a bit of still water. that's typically where I'll see Drosera popping up. And then when the plants kind of start filling in, the Drosera kind of disappears. But Venus flytrap was always embedded really tightly amongst the other grasses and forbs in these wet areas, and actually kind of never in the water. Anytime you had just a little bit of elevation, just, I mean, even 2 or 3 inches, that's where I saw Venus flytrap. And so I've unsuccessfully tried to grow Venus flytrap several times. And I think that if I had to do it again, I would crowd it in and amongst other species of plants, presumably because there's a microclimate kept there around the Venus flytrap that maintains the humidity. I suspect that most of the lack of success I've had with keeping carnivorous plants as house plants or even something on the back patio is because they dry out far too quickly. And I think we've all heard that if you want to keep pitcher plants, whether it's Nepenthes or Sarracenia, alive, that you keep distilled water in the pitchers. But that's kind of also, it sounds like kind of when you get chapped lips and you put chapstick on it. Well, it's really because you're internally profoundly dehydrated, and the chapstick doesn't really kind of infuse you with moisture. It just tries to prevent a little bit more moisture loss. So that discovery of Dionaea, the Venus flytrap, in and amongst really a tight choke of grasses and forbs was really a lesson to me about how to keep that plant, but also about how to keep my house plants healthier, particularly in winter, by crowding them in tight spaces. And I've had great success with houseplants since. I totally took it off on a tangent. I could hear crickets.
You know, the most important thing besides keeping them wet for carnivorous plants is making sure that they get their dormancy. If they don't, you don't let them go dormant in the winter with a cold dormancy, you lose them.
Yeah.
And don't feed them hot dogs. Little kids love feeding them hot dogs and hamburgers, and it's just not a good idea.
They must learn that at the science centers or something.
Yeah. Well, Aaron,
what are some of your favorite? I know you mentioned that Sarracenia was one of your favorites. Presumably, aesthetically, do you have a favorite carnivorous plant that you like to grow? And do you have one that you aspire to get that you haven't gotten yet?
You know, Venus flytraps are fun to grow. But I'm really more into them for the science as opposed to trying to collect them. So I don't have any on my bucket list to add to the collection, as it were.
Not even an Audrey from Little Shop of Horrors?
Well, you know, I do have an Audrey hand puppet.
Awesome.
Right, that I use when I give talks. Now, Audrey Jr. is a cross between a Venus flytrap and a butterwort, a pinguicula. Those are so far distantly related to one another, they really wouldn't cross. But it is a big hit in high schools around the world.
I'm sure. Speaking of Aubrey, that would make a great pet. That would make a great pet story, I think.
It could.
John, how are your little ones at your house doing? How's Chewy doing?
Well, you know, Preston, I'm glad you asked, because I took Chewy for a walk today. And we did a long walk, and so we left Emma at home. We had to bribe her to stay, of course. But in my walk, I saw this raptor, and it was a raptor that I didn't recognize. And it was, you know, flying low over this meadow, hunting, kind of zigzagging back and forth. And, you know, Chewy and I passed it, and I was like, huh, what's that? And, you know, I know raptors, and so I know the raptors of my area, and so I was kind of, and, you know, it's funny, because I should tell you that Susanna teases me all the time that I always joke that I've seen the most rare thing in the world, but there's some truth in this, because, like, one time when we were in Ecuador, Susanna took me to a forest called Pasachoa, where the last Andean guans were breeding, and one flew right up in front of us. And so I'm like, you know, hey, what's that? And, you know, there it is. And I've seen 13 Andean condors kettling at the same time together. And, you know, so I have all these moments of seeing wildlife at its best. And so I saw this raptor. I didn't know what it was. I came back home. I got on Facebook, and another fellow who's been a guest on our show is Alonzo Abogadas, and he's he's a naturalist here in the area, and he has a site on Facebook called Capital Naturalist, and so I described this bird on there, and I was like, "What is this?" And it turns out it was a northern harrier, and I Googled images, and sure enough, that's what it was. And I had never seen one in my life. And here I was in my backyard seeing a bird that most of the time is not anywhere around here. You know, it's a more northern bird. So, and, you know, Chewy just kind of, you know, went along as I was watching this bird. I didn't get any pictures. I didn't have a real camera with me, and it wasn't close enough. But really, really fantastic pet story tonight because of taking a walk and seeing Chewy. How about you, Preston?
Well, you know, I've got these goats and this horse. And I told you about the horse trying to break in and scaring me at night. And Stinkabutt, she's beginning to behave funny recently. She seems very skittish and eager to fight, and her hiney seems inflamed. So I think that perhaps it's, well, spring is in the air. Knucklehead, her partner, is fixed, but he still kind of knows a little bit kind of like what to do. He goes for it, but he's not really committed. It's almost like the impulse strikes, but he's distracted by some fresh new grass. But what I'm enjoying watching them do now is strain through the fence to grab the tiniest little green leaf, because they have absolutely denuded anything that they can reach. I mean, there's not even like a blade of grass left on the ground. They are incredible eaters. And when they're not actively eating, they seem to be vomiting their food back up to chew on it. I mean, it's just a repulsive lifestyle. But fortunately, they're cute. So I can't resist. But they're also these Angora goats, you know, so they're beginning to kind of shed and get these really big dreadlocks. I mean, it's not a pretty time in the goat world unless you're into kind of like lovemaking that never happens and matted coats. If you're into that, let me tell you, get you some goats, because springtime is your time.
I tell you guys, that's why I stick to cactus.
Well, tell
Aaron,
us a cactus
did you say
story.
Cats or cactus?
cacti, you know, plants with spines. They're impossible to kill. They're impossible to kill, and you don't have any allergies to them. It's just great.
You just don't pet them.
No.
It might be a sharp experience.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, Aaron, there with your cacti, have you brought a beverage to share with us?
Well, you know, you can take you can distill agave down and get some good mezcal or tequila.
That's true.
There you go.
John, I don't has anyone brought tequila on the show yet?
Not that I know of.
Ooh, I'll have to fix that one.
Sweet.
But I definitely can't imbibe in the middle like I well, typically do. I'm enjoying another Big Boss Brewery concoction here called Angry Angel. And it's a Kolsch-style ale. Real nice, clean, sharp. After having, you know, kind of like pollen-induced cold for the last week, I didn't want anything with any kind of weight to it. Mm. It is basically Kolsch and Hefeweizen from here to Halloween. So I may be a bit boring in that regard on these, John, but it's got to be lightweight from here on out. What did you bring?
I have a really fine brew from one of my favorite breweries that I've had on many times, Adroit Theory, which is right here in Percival, right around the corner from my place, and it's another New England style Imperial IPA, and this is called the AK Edition, Dissident Warrior Edition, and these guys brew in small batches, and this is 8% alcohol by volume, so reasonable. For me,
that's pretty decent. That'll do the job. Yeah,
as you say, we drink for the effect, right?
Drink for effect, absolutely.
Just don't mix it with mushrooms.
Yes,
and don't pet the cacti.
I was going to say it depends on the mushrooms, but
I see. I was waiting for that one. Well, fellas, cheers. Aaron, thank you so much for tonight. We really appreciate not only a return visit, but an opportunity to talk about your new book and really just better understand the wild world of carnivorous plants.
Well, thank you very much, and we'll catch you another time.
All right. Cheers, everyone.
Cheers. We'll see you on the flip side.
Take it away, PT.